Welcome back to the Maritime History Program here on Boat Radio. I'm your host, Brandon Huebner, and this week we progress on to Episode 9, which I've entitled The New Kingdom, Maritime War and Maritime Peace. Last time we left off as the Second Intermediate Period overtook the Middle Kingdom of Egypt's history. We saw how the Middle Kingdom declined around 1750 BCE, a point that was relatively contemporaneous with the death of Hammurabi, the decline of the First Babylonian Empire, and the drying up of Mesopotamian sea trade. While the Persian Gulf trade of Mesopotamia steadily declined over a period of 150 years or so, Egypt entered the Second Intermediate Period rather abruptly. We saw how the decline of the Middle Kingdom may have steadily led to the cliff, where that abrupt drop happened. But once it did happen, Egypt's long-distance sea trade also fell off precipitously. From the death of Sobekneferu, which ended the 12th dynasty, Egypt underwent a fracturing of power that saw several different dynasties ruling contemporaneously. Then, around 1650 BCE, a weakened Egypt was easily invaded by a warring people known as the Hyksos. They actually established their own dynasty, the 15th, and they gained a large measure of control over most of Egypt. But since there is practically no maritime evidence connected to the Hyksos, I'll have to leave a discussion of their invasion to some of the other fine books and podcasts out there that cover ancient history. There is one interesting maritime reference connected to the Hyksos, but other than this one, it's sufficient to say that Egypt remained fractured and under partial control of the Hyksos until approximately 1550 BCE, when the last two 17th dynasty Theban kings, Sekhenre-Tau and his son Khamos, these two kings led the Egyptians in a final victory over the Hyksos to accomplish Egypt's liberation. Khamos is the king who we have to thank for the maritime evidence from the end of the Second Intermediate Period. This evidence comes in the form of two specific stelae that are connected to Khamos as he recounts his efforts to wrest the cities in Middle Egypt from the control of the Hyksos. His strategy was to carry out a shock-and-awe campaign against the Middle Egyptian towns that had supported the Hyksos or come under their control. He hoped to win these towns back easily and weaken the morale of the Hyksos without too much cost. The Carnarvon tablet is the archaeological find that tells us that Khamos wisely utilized the highway of the Nile to move at least a portion of his army north to the city of Avaris, which was a focal point of his campaign. It was also the main center of Hyksos control in Lower Egypt. This tablet records Khamos as saying, quote, "I sailed downstream a victor to drive out the Asiatics according to the command of Amun, my brave army in front of me like a blast of fire." There is a second stela attributed to Khamos that goes into further detail about how exactly he utilized boats in his attack on Avaris. On this tablet we read, quote, "I put in at Perjedkin, my heart happy, so that I might let Apopi," which is a reference to the Hyksos king, also known as Apophis, "so that I might let Apopi experience a bad time, that Syrian prince with weak arms, who conceives brave things which never come about for him. I arrived at Yenit of the southward journey, and I crossed over to them to greet them. I put the fleet already equipped in order, one behind the other, in order that I might take the lead, setting the course with my braves, flying over the river as does a falcon, my flagship of gold at their head, something like a divine being at their front. I made the mighty transport boat beach at the edge of the cultivation, with the fleet behind it, as the sparrowhawk uproots plants upon the flats of Avaris." The appearance from this inscription leads us to believe that Camos used transport boats and smaller ships as amphibious vessels where he could launch an attack on the city of Avaris, fighting from the ships onto land, rather than from ship to ship, as he would have done if it were a purely naval battle. The conclusion of the inscription gives the impression that Camos was successful in his attack, but some scholars think that Camos may have inflated the records of his accomplishments. The stela goes on to quote Camos as boasting, "I have not left a plank to the hundreds of ships of fresh cedar which were filled with gold, lapis, silver, turquoise, bronze axes without number, over and above the moringa oil, incense, fat, honey, willow, boxwood, sticks and all their fine woods, all the fine products of Retanu. I have confiscated all of it. I haven't left a thing to Avaris, to her own destitution. The Asiatic has perished." Rather boastful from Camos, and I should add that the location Retanu in that inscription is a reference to the southern portion of the Levant, so it's obvious that goods from the Levant were still traveling up the Nile, even under Hyksos' control. Some even think that these Hyksos may have also come from the region of the Levant, although their origin is a bit more shrouded in mystery and debate. In all, though, these inscriptions from Camos give us our best glimpse into the state of maritime trade in the Second Intermediate Period, even if they also record the moments that this period was in its final stages. When Camos died, he had accomplished much of the task of driving the Hyksos north. His successor, Amos I, is seen as the first pharaoh of Egypt's new kingdom. Also the first king of the 18th dynasty, Amos spent his reign working to reestablish a centralized government, similar to those that had come before. Once the government was again solidified, the earliest pharaohs of the 18th dynasty focused all of Egypt's resources on expanding territorial control once again. In the south, they waged a campaign to retake control of Nubia, a campaign that was waged on land by and large. The northern campaign saw the Hyksos pushed north, back to what some feel was their original homeland of the Levant. As Egypt's armies pushed them north, the 18th dynasty pharaohs figured that they might as well add more and more northern territory to their kingdoms. By the time Thutmose III took the throne in 1479, he led numerous military campaigns to take control of more territory to Egypt's north. Thutmose III pushed so far north that Egypt technically controlled territory in southern Syria. However, Egypt had become so extended by reaching this far north that Thutmose's administration of the territory in the Levant, well, it was dependent on the fact that he maintained control of the port cities there. Byblos is an example of a port city that was briefly subjected to Egyptian rule. This situation of Egypt's overextension and its reliance on port city control is revealed to us in the text of the Napata Stele, also sometimes called the Gebel Barkal Stele. The stelae describes Thutmose III's northern campaigns against the Hyksos and the Mitanni. This second group was a group that rose to power in the region of central Mesopotamia and over west into northern Syria. This text describes Thutmose, quote, sailing to the northern border of Asia, where he, quote, ordered that many ships be built of cedar from the mountains of God's land in the neighborhood of the mistress of Byblos. In preparing for his Syrian campaign, the text of the stela tells us how every harbor His Majesty came to was supplied with fine bread, various breads, oil, incense, wine, honey, fruit more numerous than anything, beyond the comprehension of His Majesty's army. And that's no exaggeration. That last part about exaggeration there is actually written on the ancient Egyptian stela. The scribe must have felt it necessary to reiterate his honesty and accurate reporting of the facts. But anyway, after describing this victory at the Battle of Megiddo, the stele also describes how Thutmose required tribute of his subjects. It says, "All chiefs of Lebanon built the royal boats in order to sail south in them and bring all the precious things of Lebanon to the palace." This same stela, named after the city of Napata in Nubia to Egypt's south, also tells of Thutmose's exploits on the southern front. The stela was named after the city of Napata because it was discovered in Nubia, and after it describes Thutmose's victory over the Nubians, it also tells how he required tribute from his Nubian subjects. He wrote, quote, "They pay me tribute as one man, being taxable millions of times in numerous things of the top of the earth, much gold from Wawat, its amount without bound. One built there for the palace every year 8 boats, and many transporters for the crews, beside the tribute. The Nubians bring ivory and ebony. Precious wood from Kush was brought to me as beams of Daum palms, and wooden things without number as acacia wood from the southland. My army made them in Kush, which existed there in millions, beside 8 boats and many transporters made of Daum palms, which my majesty had fetched by force. One built for me in Jahi every year, from genuine cedars of the Lebanon, which were brought to the palace." A bit repetitive there, but you get the idea of his tribute and how important it was to his display of power. An image depiction of this tribute being received by Thutmose can be found in the tomb of his vizier, a man named Rekmire. His tomb at Luxor is lavishly decorated and abounds with painted depictions of events from his life. One depiction shows him making a journey by ship to go receive a decoration from the pharaoh. There is a more historically important image from this same tomb, though. It's a depiction of the various people groups who paid tribute to Thutmose III. Among them, the Nubians are clearly identifiable because they bring various African animals that were common to the area then called Nubia, but not to areas further north. The Syrians are also identifiable thanks to their commonly depicted style in ancient Egyptian imagery. The most interesting group is a group bringing gifts of vases and small statues. The style of dress and hair with which this group is depicted has led many scholars to identify them as natives of the island of Crete. This island would probably have been under Minoan control during the reign of Thutmose III, and we'll certainly talk about Crete further in our upcoming episodes. Egypt called these people from the islands in the Mediterranean to their north the people of the isles in the midst of the sea, and the possible connections between Egypt and the Minoans are fascinating, but as I said, we'll talk about them in the near future. With that, we're going to transition from looking at Egypt's territorial expansion during the New Kingdom, which was, as we've seen, an expansion that relied heavily on the Nile and on the supply routes to the Levantine port cities. But our second and final topic for today involves a woman pharaoh who reigned concurrently with Thutmose II and III. This was an Egyptian queen named Hatshepsut. Hatshepsut was by far the most successful female pharaoh in Egypt's recorded history, and her reign is seen as relatively peaceful in comparison with the reigns of her predecessors. Her reign was a time when Egypt began to establish its foreign trade connections, following the occupation of the Hyksos and the foreign trade hiatus of that period. Hatshepsut herself was responsible for a large part of the foreign trade renaissance. And a relief from her temple gives us some marvelous insight into a voyage that she launched in the 9th year of her reign, so we could estimate around 1469. What's marvelous about this particular relief is that it gives us our best information about the land of Punt, since that is the place where Hatshepsut sent her expedition. Not only is there information about Punt, but this relief is also important because the intricacy of the relief gives us a wealth of information about the construction of the ships. It's so detailed that we even can get information about the type of marine life in the waters through which the voyage traversed. The fish in the relief, for example, are carved in such detail that modern ichthyologists are able to identify the exact species of fish that the Egyptian artist intended to depict about 3,500 years ago. In its entirety, this relief from Hatshepsut's temple tells a story in several different scenes. The first several scenes at the bottom of the relief show the departure of the fleet from Egypt. There appear to be 5 ships in total. 3 of them are still at sail, with their square-rigged sails unfurled, while 2 of them are slightly further ahead and seem to have already arrived at Punt. Their sails are stowed along the ship's yards, and a smaller boat laden with sacks and large jars is making land after it's been dispatched from one of the larger ships. The text above the anchored ships describes the scene this way. Sailing on the sea and making a good start for God's land. Making landfall safely at the terrain of Punt. Based on the number of rowers aboard only one of the ships, 15 to a side for 30 total rowers on a ship, we can estimate that these ships used in Hatshepsut's voyage were roughly 23 meters long, or about 75 feet. The ships themselves highly resemble the Egyptian ships of previous centuries, ships that we've discussed in previous episodes. Each of the ships in this depiction has a hogging hawser or truss to add that stability to the hull, while the boom and yard on each ship are curved, possibly to help the sail gain an optimal level of curvature to better capture the Red Sea winds while it is at sail. Apart from the depiction of the ships themselves and the marine life that they shared the Red Sea with during their voyage, the relief is also important for its depiction of the land of Punt and the goods that Egypt traded for at the far end of their voyage. The scenes in the middle of the relief show Egyptian sailors carrying goods from Punt back to the ships. The text describing this scene says that the Egyptians were loading the ships very heavily with the marvels of the land of Punt, with all kinds of good herbs of God's land, and heaps of nodules of myrrh, with trees of fresh myrrh, with ebony and pure ivory. I will not make any ebony and ivory jokes here. Case closed. The list also includes items like gold, wood, incense, animals like baboons and hounds, not to mention the servants that Egypt took back with them from Punt. The scenes depicting their return journey show the ships heavily laden with the goods listed. Potted myrrh trees sit on deck, surrounded by full sacks and jars, while baboons walk along the hogging truss. In describing the arrival of the fleet back at the Karnak Temple at Thebes, the inscription says, quote, "Voyaging and arriving safely, making landfall at Karnak Temple joyfully, by the royal expedition, accompanied by chiefs of this land. They have brought the like of which has not been brought to other kings, from the marvels of the land of Punt." So, if you remember our talk last time about the various theories for the location of the land of Punt, as well as our talk about Egyptian and Red Sea geography, basically, well, you may be wondering how the fleet sailed from the Red Sea over to the Karnak Temple at Thebes, the city that happens to be located on the Nile River. The Canal of the Pharaohs that we also talked about last time wasn't constructed at this point in Egyptian history, so the only feasible possibility is that the ships and the goods they carried were transported across a wadi and back to the Nile. But, as I hope you'll also remember from our discussion of Egyptian maritime history, this was a common practice, dating all the way back to the Old Kingdom. So it's a safe assumption that even Hatshepsut's voyage to Punt did the same thing in crossing the wadis of the eastern desert before and after their New Kingdom voyage. The concluding few scenes of this relief show denizens of the land of Punt bringing the goods of their homeland before Queen Hatshepsut, bowing down before her and saying, "Hail to thee, King of Egypt, Lady Ra, shining like the solar disk." A final interesting tidbit from the Punt voyage relief is that Ramesses the Great, a pharaoh who reigned several centuries after Hatshepsut, well, he attempted to remove her name from the relief and put down his own name in its place. Obviously, he felt that he could claim the glory of the voyage for his generation and any generations to follow. Despite his best attempts, though, archaeologists weren't fooled, and we now know for sure that Hatshepsut was the one who was really responsible for the voyage to Punt, or to whatever southern lands they may have actually gone to. As we begin to wrap up today, I wanted to shift gears slightly to talk about a project that demonstrates just how advanced ancient Egyptian maritime technology was. This project took place in 2009, when Cheryl Ward, who is a maritime archaeologist at Florida State University, she, along with a crew of university students, embarked on an 18-day Red Sea voyage aboard a reconstructed Egyptian ship. The reconstruction was largely based on this depiction of ships from the Hatshepsut relief, but other information came from fragmentary artifacts discovered at other Egyptian Red Sea ports, like Mersa Gawasis, and they also added hull measurements from the Dasher boats to help them arrive at their reconstruction. The resulting ship was named Min of the Desert, which was in honor of the Egyptian fertility god that's depicted on shrines at Mersa Gawasis. Min of the Desert weighed 30 tons and measured in at about 66 feet long. The construction techniques that they used were almost exactly like the techniques we've already seen in our jaunt through ancient Egyptian maritime history. In trying to use original techniques, the hull itself was built through the use of individual planks fastened by unpegged mortise and tenon joints. Linen fiber and beeswax was used as a sealant to waterproof the plank edges of the hull, a technique that isn't readily evidenced by ancient Egyptian artifacts, but that it's still entirely feasible for them to have used. The square linen sail, the mast and rigging, and the hogging truss are all modeled almost exactly from the depictions of the Hatshepsut Punt ships. Min of the Desert also contained two quarter rudders, as are also shown in the relief from Hatshepsut's temple, where the rudders are lashed to stanchions to help steer the ship even in a strong wind. Perhaps the only major difference between the relief and Min of the Desert is the use of rowing oars for propulsion. The reconstructed ship relies mainly on the sail for propulsion, and according to Miss Ward, even she was surprised by the speed and stability with which the square-rigged sail carried the ship. However, the ship was outfitted with rowing capabilities, which would have only been used to maneuver it in and out of anchorage positions, and definitely not as a main means of propulsion, especially on the open water. As is my custom, I'll post some pictures of this beautiful ship on my main website, along with the Hatshepsut voyage depictions and most of the other depictions we've talked about today, So you can visit the website if you're curious what those look like. To track back to our earlier item, the relief at Hatshepsut's temple, this is generally seen as the best single evidence for Egypt's connection to the land of Punt, and it's among the most well-known of all Egyptian temple reliefs. From Hatshepsut's voyage forward to the epic clash between the Egyptians and the Sea Peoples, there isn't a whole lot that is unique in the way of maritime evidence or developments from Egypt. Before we wrap up today, though, I do want to point out one interesting theme that maritime historian Lincoln Payne draws from the Egyptian depictions of Punt. Going back to our talk last time about the tale of the shipwrecked sailor, you may recall that the serpent on the island with the shipwrecked sailor claimed to be the Prince of Punt. When the sailor attempted to garner the serpent's favor by promising to lavish him with the riches of Egypt, the serpent just laughed at his foolishness, saying that Egypt's wealth was nothing compared to the wealth of Punt. Combine that with today's look at Hatshepsut's voyage to Punt, where we again saw that even the New Kingdom Egyptians had a high demand for the myrrh and wealth from this fabled land, while at the same time the natives of Punt were also depicted as subservient to the awesome Egyptians. Payne points to this theme, Egypt's desire for Eastern wealth, while at the same time feeling superior to the Easterners. He says that perhaps this is the first depicted occurrence of a theme that continues to this day. Western nations have continually complained about a wealth of goods coming from the East, cheapening the worth of Western products. Modern complaints of trade imbalance or immigration come to mind, while medieval and Renaissance fascination with the exotic wares of the East also follow in this similar theme. It's certainly early in the life of the program here still, and a fair portion of this East-West trade did take place on land, but keep an eye out for this theme to pop in and out of our discussions in the future. Hatshepsut's voyage to Punt brought us up to 1469 BCE, and from there, a few final notable mentions will bring us to a close. The first comes from the tomb of Hoi at Kurnat Murai, Thebes. This is a wall painting. It's dated to 1360 BCE, and it depicts one ship that is basically the same as the ship depicted in Hatshepsut's temple. The Hoi ship is the same shape, although it lacks the stylized stem and stern. Both depictions show ships with square-rigged sails, quarter rudders, rowing or outfitting, and relatively simple rigging. The major difference with the Hoi ships is that their decks contain what seem to be cabin-type shelters, where the ships in Hatshepsut's temple only contained raised portions that were guarded by railing but that had no enclosures. Our second notable mention, I should say mentions, really, comes from the famed tomb of Tutankhamun. From King Tut's tomb, Howard Carter pulled 14 different boat models, all of them in pristine condition. Again, while none of these models contain any features that we haven't already discussed at some point, they do make beautiful examples of the way New Kingdom Egyptians decorated their boats and ships. King Tut's tomb contained small ceremonial boat models, but one model in particular gives us a full-color glimpse at a ship that is highly similar to the Hatshepsut and Hoi ship depictions, even if the model is hundreds of scale sizes smaller. Even a boat that we mentioned early on in the podcast, a papyrus reed canoe, was taken from the tomb, and we can see from this that even the simplest of boat designs remain in use throughout history. And with those decorative boat models pulled from the tomb of perhaps the most famous Egyptian pharaoh, we'll bring our look at the New Kingdom and our episode today to a close. We're just about out of steam. Although these final few items came from around 1360 BCE, not much changed after that until the Late Bronze Age collapse began to affect Egypt, starting in around 1200. From there, the Sea Peoples enter the narrative, and the widespread transition that took place in the whole of the Mediterranean and the ancient world is best left for a series of episodes all to themselves. Just to give you a rough idea of where we're going to be heading in the upcoming episodes and weeks, here are my thoughts. I anticipate our next episode to look at a specific use of ships throughout all of ancient Egypt's history. That is, ships used as heavy transport vessels. We've already seen many ships used as transport for smaller goods, even for timber from Byblos. But the Egyptians did make frequent use of ships to transport their stone and large building supplies that they used in their monumental building projects. The unique aspects of transporting such items by ship should fit well into a single episode, although it might be a little bit shorter than normal. After that, I plan to circle back around to early periods and look at some of the civilizations that we haven't yet turned our focus on. Some of them we've barely even mentioned. These are civilizations like the Minoan, the Mycenaean, and the earliest glimpses of the Phoenician. The Indus Valley civilization, along with a few other people groups, are known to have had maritime capabilities by virtue of their mention in the histories of Egypt and Mesopotamia. But hard evidence of Indus Valley maritime history is much more scarce. Really, though, once we look at these few civilizations, we will be right back up to the watershed moment of ancient history, the Late Bronze Age collapse. The Sea Peoples play a role in that story, so maritime history does as well. Once we get past that, we'll be into the period where we start to look at the Phoenicians in earnest, and we also begin to see the rise of the Greeks and the emergence of the first true maritime civilizations of the ancient world. All of that long summary to say, we won't be hurting for subject matter in the least, and I hope you'll stick around as we move through that. That does it for us once again here today, though. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you'll join me again next week at this same time. If you like what you've heard today, visit the program page on boatradio.net. There you can find a link to my main website, where I have supplementary maps, images, source lists, and other beneficial supplementary materials. The website also has info about how you can help support the continued production of this free and independent program. Plus, you can find links to connect with the program on social media for other news and interesting info about maritime archaeology and history. I hope you'll join me next week and every week thereafter as we progress through the stories of maritime history together. Until next time, fair winds and following seas. Thanks for listening to the Maritime History Program.